Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Center. I'm Vishnu Shom. On the program tonight, a serious alert across the country after a key cancer and liver drug in circulation are found to be spurious. The alert came from the World Health Organization and concerns the cancer drug Adcetris and the liver medicine Defitelio. The counterfeits are from 8 batches in circulation and have been found abroad as well, in Turkey in fact. On this program, counterfeit medicines in circulation in India. It is a huge problem. It's been known for years. How widespread is it? What has been done to address the problem after multiple alerts over the years? Next up, and this is going to be at 1:30, part 2 of our deep dive into China's construction activity in Aksai Chin. How they are constructing massive military complexes underground as the Indian Armed Forces continue to build up infrastructure above ground. And finally, it's a journey deep into the sea. After Chandrayaan, India is set to launch Samudrayaan with the deep sea diving vessel Matsya. What is the science beneath this and what is the mission? That's also coming up on this program. But first, let's move on to our main discussion. A look at spurious drugs in India, the nature of the threat and the latest World Health Organization alert. Joining us now, Dr. Viranchi Shah, Dr. Gopal Dabade. I'm also joined by Dr. Sunila Garg. Thanks very much for being with us. Dr. Sunila Garg, let me come to you first. As far as this liver drug is concerned and this cancer drug, how big could be the numbers of fake drugs in circulation?
I think basically one thing which we have to be very clear is that 1 in 10, you know, medicines are either, you know, substandard medicines or they're fake medicines. And when we are talking of the medicines which are related to liver and cancer, because the burden of disease is also quite very high. Hello. So we need to see that whether these drugs are, you know, as far as this news is concerned, these drugs are not manufactured in India. But then due to lack of adequate governance and all, which is very important in case of, you know, falsified medicines, these drugs, they make an entry to, you know, in Indian context. But overall, we know that, you know, WHO has got monitoring and surveillance mechanism, which was established in 2013. And this today's report talks about, you know, the combination of about 100 review studies, which are, you know, done from 88 countries and also, which are also talking of that there is limitation in reporting as well. So we need to be very cautious about, you know, both, you know, from the CDSO perspective and Drug Controller General of India, we need to be very conscious about the quality monitoring of these drugs, the availability of these drugs. And another very big challenge is the availability of drugs through internet, which, you know, tend to bypass all the channels. So this is where we need to be, you know, quite conscious about, you know, about the availability of the fake and substandard drugs.
Dr. Garg, just a quick clarification. These two drugs in question, one for the liver, one for cancer, are not Indian drugs, right? They're imported drugs.
Yes. Yeah. So
that's important. And I think that we established this in the beginning because in the last several months, there have been concerns over substandard Indian drugs, specifically cough medication being sold outside, et cetera, et cetera. What we are talking about on this program are counterfeit drugs, which are not manufactured or do not originate from India, but are still available in the Indian market. Let me just take that across to Dr. Gopal Dabade. Dr. Dabade, firstly, is there anything that you can add as far as these drugs are concerned? And secondly, this glaring statistic of 1 in 10 drugs sold in India being either substandard or counterfeit. How does that actually happen?
Yeah, this is actually... first of all, thank you very much for inviting me on this to share some of my thoughts. I think this is actually the underworld. And probably these drugs were ordered online. And there are a lot of things about these drugs. Actually, these drugs are not allowed for marketing in India. So these drugs were procured through unethical and illegal means by somebody who got it. And it has, in a very large scale, and has flooded our market, unfortunately. So what is important is, again, that the WHO has to tell us about all these things. We should have our own drug regulatory mechanism. We should have taken this issue very seriously and then brought it to the notice of the community, the people at large. But I think that has not happened. And that is what should really happen. And for that to happen, We need a very rigorous, strong, and, you know, well-informed drug regulatory authority in our country.
You know, if you just, and perhaps Dr. Viranshi Shah can look at this. If you just look at fake drug rackets uncovered across India in the last 1 year, I've got some statistics. In UP, Bihar, Haryana, Himachal Pradesh, and Telangana, there have been spurious drug rackets which have been detected in six states. Right, fake drugs have been manufactured in Himachal Pradesh and in Haryana. Suppliers have pasted invoices of other goods to fool tax officials. Special fake drug squads have been formed across states. And there is a joint effort, etc., etc. So my question is this, sir. How widespread is this?
Oh, first of all, thank you for having me here on this program. As far as these two drugs are concerned, it is well established that they were not manufactured in India and they have entered India through some unregistered and unscrupulous supply chains. Coming to your question on the larger issue, like how big this number is, one of the most recent surveys that we have with us is a survey conducted by the central government around 3-4 years back. It had around 50,000 samples drawn across India. And out of this massive survey, we could identify that there is about 3-4% of the products sold in India were failing to meet some or the other specifications. Less than 0.5%, I think it's about 0.3% of the drugs, as per that survey, were spurious, the fake ones. So I think... this is the broad numbers. India does have a very strong law that has a term from 7 years to life imprisonment for manufacturing or dealing with dealing in fake drugs. Every year, almost 100,000 samples are drawn by the state and central government authorities across India. And I think the number of percentages is fairly about 2 to 3% of samples not complying to specifications and less than 0.5 spurious drugs that are identified. I think, so in terms of numbers, I would say India is much better than most of the developing countries, much in line with the regulated world. But in terms of the impact on the society, even one single fake drug cannot be accepted. I believe that a lot of regulatory changes have already been recently undertaken. The Drug Act is being revamped. The regulations are being revamped. And I believe that we call ourselves the pharmacy of the world. We truly are doing serious efforts in this direction.
Oh, absolutely. But we'll talk about that in a while. Murli Nilkanthan, former Global General Counsel at Cipla and Glenmark, is that the problem over here? That, you know, we've got, yes, we have a central regulator, but we've also got state regulators. And therefore, there is no one central authority which goes about from lab to lab, manufacturing facility to manufacturing facility, to actually, you know, benchmark quality, number one. And number two, the effort to actually find people with fake bottling units who are actually manufacturing fake drugs, again, that needs to be done by a central authority. In both cases, we are lacking.
Let me just add some facts to this. Adcetris fake was available in Bombay, and the Mumbai police arrested people with that drug on 1st October 2021. So the Indian authorities, which includes the FDA, knew that there was plenty of fake Adcetris in the market. We needn't have to wait 2 full years for the WHO to issue an alert based on what Turkey told them. So let's start from there, that we knew in Bombay and we caught some people with this drug on 1st October 2021. So what does the WHO expect? That when we find something like this, we inform the WHO. So contrary to what the public opinion is, WHO doesn't do any research in India on substandard drugs. What WHO publishes every year is a review of literature, which is somebody else done the research and they published it. Secondly, in this case, as with all of these, we don't know where the product came from, except from what Turkey tells us that they found some samples. I'll give you another example. We found a lot of Covishield during the COVID era in Africa. Clearly, it was not made by Serum. That's why we found that it was a fake. It had the wrong batch number. It didn't have the size, all of that. So it's easy to say, you know, who's supposed to do this? The answer to that is each country's regulator is meant to regulate and report to WHO. That's the first issue. Secondly, when we say that we don't have a very low percentage, we have a very low percentage of bad quality drugs. Mm-hmm. The problem is that we only sample paracetamol, ibuprofen, and some crap like that. We don't sample the expensive stuff, which is where the counterfeiting really is. Think about it this way. Will you counterfeit a Bata shoe or a Louis Vuitton bag? What makes more sense for a counterfeiter? But we don't sample that. So we don't know what the quality on that is. So the data we have for India is terrible because we only sample the cheap stuff. Where the counterfeiting happens is the expensive stuff.
And no, finally, but are we doing in terms enough in terms of sampling as a central regulator?
No, that
was my question, which I was asking. The fact it's that there not is,
it's not whether center or state. The state can sample. So the state regulators go out regularly and sample, or they are meant to.
Is that
but they always? No, for two reasons.
Because we've seen recently that it's not. In the case of, you know, cough medication in several states.
So that is not a sampling issue, right? So this was not caught in a sample. So people died, so they went and got the product.
Right, exactly. When which is why you need to have an agency that samples. So my question is, are we okay with the quality of state samplers?
I don't think the problem is with the quality of the sampling. It is, as Dinesh writes in his book, writes in his book, The Truth Pill. They don't have a budget to go and sample these things. So they sample the cheapest medicines, so not the most expensive ones.
So the entire process of sampling at the level of the state is problematic. And so what about the center? Is it realistic to expect the center to have an agency which can move from industry to industry, factory to factory, batch to batch, and get a realistic idea of what's good and what's not? Yes or no?
I don't think the issue is who's the boss here. Whether you call yourself a state agency or a central agency, it's going to be the person in Bombay here who's going to do it. And finally, on regulation, I just like to say that despite everything that has been said about the great regulatory network that we have and the Drugs Act and punishment being life imprisonment and all of that, I'd like to understand if anybody can tell me, and I've done the research until from 1959 till 2023, I could not find one imprisonment.
Yeah.
How many kids have died? How many people have died?
Yeah.
Thousands in India.
Yeah.
These are well known. How many people have gone to jail? Zero. And so, you know, we've got bad regulation, bad enforcement. Therefore, you have bad manufacturing. And therefore, people will die.
Dr. Viranchi Shah, you had a point to make. Go ahead.
Yes, so I was just trying to clarify that the 50,000 odd survey that I was talking about was not specific to any specific drug or therapeutic category. It was a widely well-drawn sample survey that was done. And I would not defend that even 0.3 is acceptable. But what I'm trying to say is that the survey was actually done across India, across geographies, and across therapeutic ranges.
Dr. Garg, you know, there's another report. It's a CAG report, a Comptroller and Auditor General report of 2022 on substandard drugs sold to patients under the Central Health Scheme. And the numbers are ridiculous. And this is just obviously one section, of medication sold to a particular group of citizens. In Mumbai, 26 lakh units of drugs found substandard. Mumbai, 11 lakh units of substandard drugs sold. Nagpur, 3 lakh units of substandard drugs found, 2 lakh sold. Kolkata, 3 lakh units of substandard drugs found, 2 lakh sold. So the numbers are whopping. And so let's look at this from another standpoint as well. And to make the difference between substandard drugs, which is a manufacturing sort of lacunae, and fake or spurious drugs. Both of them might have the same impact in affecting the lives of patients. But what do we know about, let's say, spurious drugs in India? In other words, they're completely fake.
I think basically it is the question of, you know, when we talk of the regulation and governance, when we are talking of fake drugs. But when you're talking of substandard drugs, it has got to do with the, you know, standards in manufacturing, supply and distribution. And when I was working, you know, for the system, I realized that, you know, we used to get a lot of supplies, you know, for the urban and rural areas also, you know, as part of our, you know, services to the community. So what we realized was we used to get that 10% samples are checked, and out of this, this has been found, you know, to be, you know, substandard, and this should be removed. So at the end of it, but by what you rightly said was that by the time the report comes in, and we have already received the drugs and they have got to be removed from the system, it they have already been distributed to a couple of patients. But when you're talking of private supply, all the more this is very true that, you know, they get distributed, you know, they get purchased quite very soon. So there is a gap between by the time the, you know, quality is checked and by the time they are supplied to, they reach people. So this gap also needs to be reduced. So, but, so basic thing is that we need to create awareness amongst, you know, not only the people who, whether we talk of Drug Controller General of India or when we talk of CDSCO, we need to look at all these parts so that, you know, there is a less of gap before they reach, you know, the system. They need to be, you know, monitored and they need to be quality certified, not that the quality report comes little later. So I feel that that is important, that we need to look at all these aspects when we are, and states have got to do, you know, repeatedly and regularly the random checks with regard to different samples. That is also very, very important.
Mr. Neelakantan, you know, after all of the recent WHO reports on spurious or substandard drugs manufactured in India being responsible for deaths abroad, the government did crack down. There was a show cause notice to 11 drug manufacturers, 20 pharmaceuticals were asked to shut down, and they introduced quality tests for drugs before exports. Do you believe this is enough? What more needs to be done to step up checks?
I think we need to be...
Mr. Neelakantan, go ahead. Mr. Neelakantan, go ahead.
You have to look carefully. A show cause notice doesn't actually mean anything in India. Somebody will write a reply, somebody will then have an answer to it, then a report will come out, then it will get challenged in court. So a show cause notice is just a farce. It's similarly, if you're going to shut down a plant, it means one thing. But in most cases, including in Maiden, they just said you can't manufacture this one product with that one brand. So you can manufacture the same product with some other brand and you can put it in the market. So none of this has really had any impact. We've had cough deaths, deaths in this country for at least 50 years. And it is the same problem. So if you're telling me something's changed miraculously in the last few months, I'd really like to know. But nothing has changed for at least 50 years in this country. It's the same drug, it's the same syrup with the same toxic ingredient, which is killing babies and has been doing for 50 years.
Dr. Garg, you know, I mean...
I think we need to have, you know, first of all, the stringent monitoring is required, number one thing. Number two is that the punishments have to be... you know, harsher, and we have not seen any, you know, person being, you know, suspended or being jailed or something. We have got, you know, fines and all that. So I feel that first of all, we need regular monitoring with regard to all drugs. What we has already been mentioned that we do, you know, quality checks with regard to cheaper drugs. But what about, you know, the drugs which are more expensive? Even, you know, when we talk of generic and patented, both types of drugs need to be, you know, monitored regularly for the quality and for whether they are really, you know, substandard drugs or they are fake drugs. So that is where also we need to look at, and also from the perspective of when they enter the Indian market, if they are fake drugs. So there also, you know, our international regulations have got to be both national and international, I'll say, have to be very strong, because we see that drugs are manufactured somewhere, they are labeled somewhere, and then they are, you know, supplied somewhere. That is another part of it. But we need to also caution people about online procurement of these drugs, where the regulation is really very weak and we can't do much about it. So I feel that, you know, the punishments have to be very stringent, but the quality control has got to be at very regular intervals and has got to be shared at regular intervals with all the stakeholders.
Dr. Dabade, would you like to come in on the point on, you know, online availability of drugs? You know, some of the websites which actually have them are reputed, but on several other occasions, they're just random websites through which you can get medicines. And they are not incumbent on the quality. They don't abide by any norms to ensure quality of the medications which they supply. Is this a loophole in the law, or should there be regulations to prevent people from, you know, selling drugs online?
Yeah, first of all, we definitely need a good regulatory mechanism in place. And what we have right now is totally very, very short. For example, in my own state of Karnataka, there is a shortage of 85% of drug inspectors. Just imagine drugs coming into the market and there is nobody to supervise. It is just like saying that our borders do not have the army in place now. It's the same thing. People are getting exposed. That is the first thing. And second thing is these two drugs, which have become very sensational news now, is not something new. Just few weeks back, we had this product, Jelucel, which is sold by the U.S. multinational Abbott. And in both these cases, at least in Jelucel case, it was the consumer who had to inform the drug regulatory authorities. And even these two drugs, Adcetris and Difetilo, that we are discussing today now, they were told by WHO. And my question is, what are our drug regulatory authorities doing? They are not adequately placed. There is corruption. And all these things have infested. And the worst part is that regulatory authorities should be autonomous and independent. There should be no political party interference in these issues. Well, the politicians and political parties can help framing the laws and bylaws, but they should not be in the decision-making position at all. That is where is this their chances come and the corruption aspect crops in. So unless we have an independent, well-defined, adequately, properly staffed drug regulatory mechanism,
exactly,
we cannot overcome these issues.
Look, these are all very frightening details, and I'd like to thank you all very much.
Yeah, and I also want to add one more thing. Lentin Commission in the year 80s has very clearly stated all this. He has said how the politician, who the health minister himself, was totally corrupt in this, and all the bureaucrats that were there at the drug regulatory authorities were totally corrupt. And I still remember one of the health minister committed died because of heart attack because of the report. The extensive report of Justice Bhaktavar Lentin needs to be revisited. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for making that point. We'll take a short break at this stage. I suspect this is a theme we'll keep revisiting on this program. But right after this short break, we'll be looking very, very closely at a new series of threats which exists in Aksai Chin with the Chinese constructing underground. This is actually part two of an investigative report which we've been working on based on new satellite imagery and what it shows. We've run part one, which shows tunnels being constructed about 50 kilometers east of the line of actual control. I've worked to sort of get more of the images together to give you before and after images. And then we've got a wonderful guest with us, General Saha, who's a former member of the National Security Advisory Board, will be with us to discuss what that report actually shows. Good evening. Last week, we brought you a special report based on satellite images on Chinese forces constructing underground in Aksai Chin, about 60 kilometers east of the line of actual control. The images are startling because they point to extensive Chinese tunnel construction and the possible creation of a full-fledged underground military complex at a time when India has stepped up our defenses extensively in Ladakh. What we now bring you in part two of our look at the construction of the Chinese underground complex are before and after images of how the area in question has been transformed since the tensions between India and China in Ladakh began from 2000 onwards. Now, there are two sets of images. The first of the 6th of December 2021, when there is minimal construction, and images of August 18 this year, less than a month back. Firstly, this is the area that we are talking about. On the right, the area located on a map of India, and on the left, a zoom in, its specific location east of the line of actual control, about 60 kilometers. The construction is on both sides of this river valley. Now, this image is from the 6th of December 2021. It shows minimal construction in the area. As you can see, it doesn't show very much. But let's now zoom in and focus on this area, which is, as you can see, an ordinary hillside. Now, that area, by the 18th of August last month, had been transformed, constructed into a reinforced bunker. The bunker itself is carved into the hill. What you see are essentially the entry and exit routes. Now, there is extensive overground construction as well. Now, this is a 2021 image. There's a little bit of construction that you see in a part of this river valley. But now, in several areas of this river valley, there is fresh construction. And also, as you can see, on the left-hand side of that image, tunnel construction at two sides. We'll bring you more details of that. But here's an image from 2021 of another part of this valley. It shows berms, which are defensive military positions. Perhaps the Chinese were trying to keep their forces over there at a time when there were tensions with India. Nothing much in that image, but let's compare and contrast. Here's an image from 2023, same area. As you can see, it shows a lot more over here. It appears to have become a mini garrison. Let's now zoom into a specific hill face. And the next image actually shows you that this hill face is nothing in 2021. But now there are two tunnels that you can clearly see being excavated in that very site. We don't know how deep or long these are. But let's give you another example. Here is another hill face from 2021. There's nothing over there at all. But in August 2023, last month, there is massive Chinese construction activity. And what we've done now is to highlight four tunnels being carved into this area. In all, there are upwards of, we believe, 11 tunnels being constructed in this entire area. Now, part of the extensive Indian build-up to counter the massive Chinese infra push is to build up our own network of roads and infrastructure in Ladakh, and it is formidable. What we can now bring you are images of Nyoma in Ladakh, just a few kilometers from the line of actual control. What you see here will become the world's highest fighter jet airfield once constructed. The shilanyas of the project is being done by Defense Minister Rajnath Singh today. In terms of infrastructure, India has completed 295 projects worth 11,000 crore rupees in just the last two or three years. But this is a significant effort at enhancing the Indian Air Force's presence right on these frontier areas along the line of actual control. Well, joining us now, two wonderful guests. We've got Lieutenant General Subrata Saha, former member of the National Security Advisory Board and former Deputy Chief of the Indian Army, and Brahma Chilani, a professor of strategic studies and a very keen China watcher. General Saha, why is China constructing underground about 50, 60 kilometers east of the line of actual control based on those images that you've seen?
Well, thank you, Vishnu, for inviting me to your show. See, the answer is very obvious. You know, this is post Galwan, post the activities of early summer of 2020, and the way India responded by that massive mobilization, not only in the area of eastern Ladakh, but across the entire line of actual control with the PRC. So this is, you know, their reaction to it, and frankly, they have had an advantage because they have been developing this infrastructure for a while. All across the Tibetan Plateau, all across, we have been seeing for quite some time now, development of airfields. We have been seeing development of, you know, missile stations. We have been seeing development of heliports. We have been seeing development of ammunition, not to talk of the road and railway infrastructure, which has been developed all along. And the story doesn't end over here. Look at the way they are, you know, developing dams, in those massive dams, the famous Three Gorges Dam and all, in such a massive manner. So this has been on for a while. But as you are very clearly pointing out, there is a sense of urgency which is now evident on the PRs, on the Chinese side. And why this sense of urgency, as I see it? Because China is finding itself deeply troubled. It is in a state of great internal turmoil, whether you want to see it from a political point of view, whether you want to see it from an economic point of view or a social point of view. One way or the other, it is in deep turmoil within. And from an external point of view, if you notice, the Chinese external relations are actually going downhill every day. I mean, just the last weekend, going by media reports, the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak appears to have told the Chinese Prime Minister, accusing him of a spy scandal. The Italian Prime Minister has told him that that we are going to pull out of the BRI. So China is in deep trouble, and we know it. It is not today. It is from the times of the Roman Empire that when there is internal crisis, the way to dissuade is to go external. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, we are seeing the kind of belligerence and aggressiveness which is going on the Taiwan side. And really, China does not know which way India is going to go, given India's growing proximity with the US, with Japan, with Australia, and several other countries in the region, in the Indo-Pacific region.
Sure.
Obviously, China is worried, so it is generating options by creating such infrastructure.
Brahma Chalani, does this also indicate a new reality which we'll have to accept? Now, we've had 19-odd rounds of military talks, and we keep talking about de-escalation and then disengagement. Now, we can de-escalate along the line of actual control, get the Chinese to move out of areas where they've come in, but disengagement is something completely different. And the reason I'm asking you this question is if they're building military complexes into the ground in Aksai Chin, which is Indian territory, the question of disengagement in their minds doesn't exist. In the past, they would come into these areas, have a military presence, but it wouldn't be anywhere close to something like this. So therefore, they are in it for the long run. They aren't moving away or disengaging ever in the way that we want them to.
You're absolutely right. By digging in for the long haul and creating a hot border, China is doubling down on a more aggressive strategy against India. There seems little prospect of a return to status quo ante along the Himalayan frontier, even if a deal of some sorts was reached in the future to ease military tensions. But there is a key question that we should be asking ourselves. What are the strategic and military objectives that are driving China's frenzied construction activity along the India frontier? The construction of new military structures, permanent structures, appears designed to consolidate China's existing territorial control, aggressively assert its claims to other Indian territories, and deter any Indian operation to regain lost territory. But the hectic construction activity also appears aimed at a broader strategic mission to stop India from opening another front against China when Xi Jinping decides to move against Taiwan. Just as China invaded India in 1962 during the US-Soviet-Cuban missile crisis, a Taiwan attack could offer India a historic opportunity to settle the Himalayan border. China may be seeking to constrict such an Indian option by creating new warfare infrastructure on its side of the India frontier. So what we are seeing is a massive buildup of Chinese military infrastructure and capabilities across the entire frontier with India. It's not just Aksai Chin. This activity is happening on the Uttarakhand-Tibet border, Sikkim-Tibet border, Arunachal-Tibet border. So the entire frontier with India is witnessing this kind of frenzied buildup of infrastructure and capability.
General Saha, you know, India has done a lot in the last couple of years as well. We've spent, what, 11,000 odd crore rupees, 295 projects along the LAC have been completed. We've actually got images up on our screen now of the new airbase in Nyoma. It's not new, but it's going to be made new effectively with fighter base operations. The point is we are trying to dig in into our territory with logistics, roads, bridges, and our own defenses. Therefore, the disparity in infrastructure which exists, do you believe that we are already or we have already cut that down to a large extent?
Yeah, certainly, Vishnu, we have cut it down to a large extent because, you know, we started investing into infrastructure. Finally, in the last 5 years, but I would imagine the real impetus has come post 2020. So we are seeing the kind of development, and the images which you're showing on the screen are of the Numa, you know, the place looks so transformed from what I have seen it last. And so clearly we are building a developing capability. And if you see the budget also for the last couple of financial years, the amount of investment which is going in for infrastructure development, whether through the border roads or for that matter, even through the armed forces, army and air force in particular, it is substantial. It is substantial investment which is going on. And I think equally important is the fact that the way India has sort of rebalanced its forces, trying to reprioritize various formations, particularly reserve formations, offensive formations from the west to the northern front. I think that's a major shift which India has done. And going into the future, I think it is imperative that we now start seeing the theater commands, which we have been, you know, which has been talked about now for the last almost 3 years. They need to come in. They need to, you know, start taking shape, because as we go forward, besides infrastructure, how well we are able to synergize our capabilities across the entire northern front would be extremely important. And so as we go into the future, I guess we'll be seeing a lot more. And when it comes to infrastructure on the Indian side, obviously we have greater challenges given the, you know, on the one hand, of course, we get the advantage of the Himalayas. And at the same time, when it comes to constructing infrastructure, sustaining that, obviously it's a greater challenge
for India. Because of terrain, right?
Because of terrain.
We have a terrain disadvantage in Ladakh, most areas.
No, it is an advantage from the war, once the war starts. But when you're building infrastructure, obviously it's much more challenging when you have to, you know, negotiate the Himalayas. The Himalayas, as we know, are still in the first, you know, so they aren't as stable as perhaps what the older mountains are. So when you see border roads has to construct roads, it's quite a challenge because of the landslides, which are so frequent. So even maintaining this infrastructure.
No, it's nightmare. Let's face it. Brahmacharani, let me ask you a direct question. And then I'll go back to General Saha. Do you believe that given the Chinese intention to build up the massive military buildup of their air bases, et cetera, and no real willingness to disengage, let alone de-escalate completely, that some sort of a military clash is inevitable in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think the risks of bloody clashes or even unlimited war can no longer be discounted, given the fact that Xi Jinping is facing increasing problems at home. We should not forget that in 1962, the Chinese invasion happened after Mao's disastrous Great Leap Forward. That Great Leap Forward created a man-made famine that killed millions of Chinese. Mm-hmm. It was in those circumstances that Mao invaded India. Today, we again see a China that is facing very strong headwinds. It is facing a international pushback against its new imperial ambitions, its economy stalled, Xi Jinping's political problems at home are growing, his appetite for risk may be also be growing. So India has to be on guard. Sure. The fact is that India is playing defense. Defense is always easier than offense. We don't have to match Chinese capabilities. We were taken unawares by China's land grabs of April 2020. We have to ensure that we're not surprised again. That is the most important aspect.
No, absolutely. And General Sahab, one final point to you. You know, when a war actually breaks out, it's not possible to right-size it. in a sense, in 2020, what we did was right-size a conflict. We never fired. They never fired. It got into fisticuffs. We even saw that in Tawang much after the Ladakh standoff. But chances are it will never end at that. Things get out of hand. There are 19 and 20-year-olds who are clashing with each other, and they're all fully armed, right? So therefore, there is a real danger of these becoming much worse than either side would want it to be.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Vishnu, there's no doubt. I agree with you entirely. You know, with reference to the question that you asked of Mr. Brahmachelani a little while ago.
Yes.
I just want to add, a couple of points. Now, if you see what is happening within China, their foreign minister went missing about a month plus back. Now, the defense minister is supposedly missing, and we have had two of their, generals from the rocket force being purged. So the point is, it is quite evident that anybody who seems to be dissenting with Xi Jinping is, being sorted out. These are very clear indicators. So now when you read them with the indicators that you have shown to us in the beginning of your program today, these are very clear battle indicators. And now if you link it with what is happening in the latest round of talks, quite clearly you are seeing some very crafty and very manipulative kind of strategy which PLA is up to. On the one hand, they are seeking a freeze of the number of forces that are deployed over there. And on the other hand, they are trying to negotiate those buffer zones, denying India the possibility of patrolling. So the point is, I think we have to be very, very watchful on how it unfolds. And in fact, all the battle indications are there for an imminence of hostilities as we go forward.
And those are very, very, that is a frightening reality. And I think it's important, and that's the reason we do these programs, is to alert people that there is a larger, wider threat of China, which goes well beyond rhetoric. These pictures do tell a real story. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for being with us. Well, we're going to move on to something far less dire and something far more hopeful. It's a journey deep into the sea. After Chandrayaan, India is set to launch Samudrayaan with the deep sea diving vessel Matsya. What is the science beneath this and what is the mission all about?
Well, after successful space missions to both the moon and the sun, Indian scientists are gearing up for quite literally a deep dive to unlock the mysteries deep in the heart of the sea. That's right, India's next big endeavor is Project Samudrayaan, which involves sending a team of three humans 6 kilometers below the ocean surface in an indigenous submersible. Now, the submersible will be called Matsya 6000. It's going to be a self-propelled manned submersible. It's going to be carrying about three humans 6,000 meters underwater, and it's going to be equipped with a suite of scientific sensors and tools for deep sea exploration. Now, the submersible will have an endurance time of about 12 hours of operational period and an additional 96 hours in case of an emergency. Now, the primary objective behind Mission Samudrayaan is to explore valuable metals and minerals in the ocean, which include cobalt, nickel and manganese and many more. Now, in fact, the submersible has been in development for nearly 2 years and it's scheduled for its inaugural sea trials off the Chennai coast in the Bay of Bengal early next year. It's being developed by the National Institute of Ocean Technology, or NIOT, in Chennai, and the Union Minister of Earth Science, Kiran Rijiju, on Tuesday shared images of the under-construction Matsya 6000 as well as some details of the Samudrayaan mission. He added that the mission will not disturb the ocean ecosystem and will support the blue economy vision of Prime Minister Modi. In fact, currently a team of scientists are looking into the design a little bit more cautiously after the horrific tragedy that befell the Titan submersible by OceanGate, which had taken tourists down to the Titanic wreckage in the North Atlantic Ocean in April earlier this year and had subsequently imploded, killing all on board. Now, Matsya 6000 is a remotely operated vehicle and its passengers will be communicating with the researchers above ground through acoustic waves at 600 meters as the pressure down in the ocean will be more than 600 times more than the pressure at sea level.
All right, Nayantara, thanks very much for sharing those details with us. My colleague Pallav Bagla, an expert in science, every aspect of that, joins us now. You've actually sat inside the Matsya, right?
Absolutely right, Vishnu. I've had the opportunity of seeing it very closely. I sat inside the Matsya and I saw the program as it is developing and as it is shaping up. It is still some distance away from doing the 6-kilometer dive. We still need the titanium sphere. That is still some distance away. The steel sphere is there and they've had a run without humans, which goes down to some level of the sea. But now they want to do a run with Matsya 6000 a little deeper into the ocean. And that would be the first trial run. But this is a very interesting project because we have at one end India's Gaganyaan program, which is to send an Indian astronaut into space from Indian soil. And then you have on the other end, the Samudrayaan program, which is to send an Indian, actually three Indians, deep below the sea to map the and look at the ocean's floor. And you'd be surprised to know we know more about the moon surface through India's Chandrayaan than we know about the Bay of Bengal and the Arabian Sea. So Samudrayaan would be charting new territory and also looking for minerals. And I can show you, Vishnu,
yeah,
I'm currently at the Institute for Minerals and Materials Technology, part of the CSIR in Bhubaneswar. And what I hold in my hand is a polymetallic nodule, which has been extracted from deep below the ocean by Indians. And this is very rich in manganese, cobalt, copper and nickel, all elements which are required to power India's economy, especially for electric vehicles. That is why there is tremendous interest to mine these polymetallic nodules, the one which I'm holding in my hand.
And, you know, just in terms of the submersible, is it itself, it's self-propelled? Does it move around like a rover or is it tethered to a ship on the surface and essentially goes up and down?
No, the Matsya 6000 is not tethered. It can propel itself on the ocean bottom and it can go in all directions, but it has a small endurance. It is not very large. It's about 12 to 16 hours of endurance under the sea, which is what is being planned. But still some distance away because these are complex technologies. And again, you'd be surprised to know there is deep involvement of the Indian Space Research Organization in Samudrayaan. The sphere of Matsya 6000 is actually going to be made by titanium, and the best technology for titanium exists with the Indian Space Research Organization. And that is how there is a interlocking of the Indian Space Research Organization with Gaganyaan at one end and Samudrayaan at the other end. But there was much talk that there would be a discussion between a person which is 6,000 meters below the sea and with an astronaut in space. That seems very unlikely.
Right.
That was far-fetched. But definitely, Samudrayaan is a very ambitious program. And India is the only country which has an ocean named after it, the Indian Ocean. So we have a lot of exclusive economic zone which is India's own. We have a 7,500-kilometer shoreline, and all of that is full of many resources, both bioresources, mineral resources, and all of them can help in India becoming the trillion-dollar economy, which India hopes to be as it becomes a developed country.
So is that what we are looking for? We've got these pictures on the screen. We're looking for rare minerals, right?
Absolutely.
And how, Pallav, the question therefore is, how do you detect rare minerals under the ocean? You can't prospect the ocean with a tiny Matsya 6000, obviously.
No. See, India has already surveyed the deep ocean. There was a whole program which has been going on for the last two decades. And we know exactly how much area. We have 75,000 square kilometers of ocean area which India can exclusively mine at the ocean bottom, and that is all been mapped, and we know exactly where there is concentration of these polymetallic nodules. So one of the efforts would be to harvest these polymetallic nodules, these small kind of black potatoes which exist as concentrated metals on the seafloor, And when you bring them up, and this is one of them which has been brought up from the Indian Ocean and I hold in my hand, this particular, it can give you a lot of critical metals, critical minerals. So there is both the blue economy at one end, where you're looking at ocean resources, and also looking at minerals.
Sure.
See, 70% of the earth is ocean. All of us are living literally on 30% of the land, which is holding the carrying capacity is being held by that 30%.
Yeah.
So if one is able to go in and tap the ocean for more, it would be a wonderful opportunity, but it has to be done carefully. It has to be done with environmental sensitiveness, which is what Minister Rijiju has said.
Pallav, great speaking to you. Thanks very much. And, you know, I mean, it's fascinating technology. It really is. And let's see how far we can get ahead with this, because it is time for India to be mounting these deep sea missions. It is absolutely essential for scientific purposes, if not anything else. Thanks very much, Pallav, for being with us. We're out of time on Left, Right and Center.